Today is Wednesday, March the 18th, 2026. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings since 1983. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard on the Progressive Radio Network live streaming on the Internet. Apple Neo versus Chromebook. The new Apple MacBook Neo is being widely compared to Chromebooks because it targets a similar audience: students, schools, and users who spend most of their time working in a web browser. But despite that overlap, the two categories remain quite different in capability, design philosophy, and price. The MacBook Neo runs macOS, a full desktop operating system. It supports professional software, native applications, development tools, and creative programs. And it works normally even when offline. Chromebooks run Chrome OS, which is designed primarily for web applications and cloud services. Chromebooks work best with tools such as Google Docs, Gmail, web browsing, and Android apps. Many Chromebook workflows assume a constant internet connection. In simple terms, the MacBook Neo behaves like a traditional laptop, while Chromebook functions more like a browser-focused computer device. Performance is another key difference. The MacBook Neo uses Apple's Apple A18 Pro chip, originally developed for high-end iPhones. Apple says it can deliver up to 50% faster performance for everyday tasks compared with some mainstream PC chips, and up to 3 times faster performance in certain AI workloads. Typical Chromebooks often use processors from Intel, such as Core i3 or N-series chips, or processors from MediaTek. These systems are designed mainly for web browsing and cloud applications. In real-world use, the MacBook Neo is better suited for multitasking, light creative work, coding, and photo editing. Chromebooks perform well for browsing, Google apps, and video streaming. Build quality is also a major difference. The MacBook Neo uses an aluminum unibody designed similar to other Macs, giving it a premium feel and strong durability. Many Chromebooks are made from plastic or a mix of plastic and metal. This reduces manufacturing costs and allows manufacturers sell the devices at lower prices. Display quality is another area where the MacBook Neo stands out. It features a 13-inch liquid retina display with 2408 by 1506 resolution and 500 nits of brightness. Typical Chromebooks generally offer 1080p displays, often with lower brightness and more limited color range in budget models. Battery life also differs. The MacBook Neo is rated for up to about 16 hours of use, while Chromebooks typically deliver 9 to 12 hours, of course depending on the model. Storage is another distinction. The MacBook Neo includes a 256GB solid-state drive as standard. Budget Chromebooks often ship with 64 to 128 of eMMC storage, which is slower but less expensive. Price remains the biggest separating factor. The MacBook Neo is expected to start at around $600, while Chromebooks sell between $250 and $500, although premium Chromebooks models can approach similar prices. In practical terms, that means the MacBook Neo is more expensive than most budget Chromebooks, but far cheaper than most traditional Macs. The Apple 2026 Strategy. There is strong historical parallel between a lower-priced Apple MacBook Neo and what happened when Apple introduced the iMac G3 in 1998. At the time, Apple was in serious trouble. The company had lost market share, its product lineup was confusing, and the Windows PC ecosystem dominated personal computing. Then Steve Jobs returned to Apple and simplified the company's strategy. The result was a single computer that changed Apple's trajectory. The 1998 strategy was the iMac reset. When Apple introduced the iMac G3, the idea was simple. Build a computer that was easier and cheaper than most Macs, but still distinctly Apple. At launch, the iMac cost about $1,300, which was far less expensive than many earlier Macs. But price wasn't the only factor. The iMac delivered three important things: a distinctive design, simple setup and internet connectivity, and enough performance for everyday computing. Consumers responded immediately. The iMac became one of the fastest-selling computers Apple had ever produced. Why the iMac work? The iMac G3 did something subtle, but powerful. It lowered the barrier to entering the Apple ecosystem. Many people who bought that machine were first-time Mac users. That mattered because once someone started using macOS, Apple software, Apple peripherals, they often stayed inside the ecosystem. Over time, these customers bought more Apple products. The same ecosystem strategy appeared again. Apple repeated this pattern several times. The 2001 iPod introduced millions of people to Apple hardware. In 2007, the iPhone became Apple's most powerful ecosystem gateway. And in 2010, the iPad expanded Apple into education and casual computing. Each time, Apple introduced a device that was simpler and more accessible than its existing products. Why the Neo could be similar? If the Apple MacBook Neo becomes real and successful, it could function as an entry-level Mac for a new generation. Instead of starting with a $1,000 laptop, students might start with a $600 Mac. That means more first-time Mac users, more developers targeting macOS, stronger integration with Apple services. The long-term value for Apple isn't just the laptop sale, it's the ecosystem expansion. The larger industry implication. In the late 1990s, the iMac G3 helped rescue Apple from near collapse and restarted Mac growth. A lower-cost Mac today wouldn't have that dramatic effect. Apple is already one of the world's largest technology companies, but it could reshape the entry point into personal computing, especially for students and first-time laptop buyers. In simple terms, the strategy is familiar. In 1998, iMac brought new users to the Mac. In 2026, a lower-priced Mac could bring students back to the Mac. History doesn't repeat exactly, but the pattern is quite similar. Apple's pricing discipline and profit margins. Apple really competes on price. Apple historically avoids competing in the lowest price tiers of any product category. Examples: the entry Apple MacBook Air typically starts around $1,000. The entry Apple iPhone models are really the cheapest smartphones in their category. Even the lower-cost Apple iPad is positioned above many competing tablets. Apple's strategy is usually premium hardware with premium margins rather than fighting in the commodity market. A $600 Mac would represent a significant departure from that philosophy. Mac profit margins are carefully managed. Apple's hardware margins are among the highest in the PC industry. Competitors such as Dell, HP, and Lenovo often operate with very thin margins on laptops. Apple tends to avoid those segments because they can become price wars with limited profitability. If Apple introduced a much cheaper Mac, two things can happen. It might sell well, but it could also reduce average Mac selling prices, which investors closely watch. Then you have the cannibalization risk. Another concern is internal competition with Apple's lineup. If an Apple MacBook Neo sold for $600, some buyers might choose it instead of an Apple MacBook Air. That means Apple could end up replacing a $1,000 sale with a $600 sale. Companies often avoid launching products that significantly undercut their own successful models. Apple already has a cheaper strategy. Instead of introducing very low-cost devices, Apple usually relies on older models at reduced prices. For example, previous generation Apple MacBook Air models often remain on sale at lower prices. Older Apple iPhone models stay in the lineup for years. This allows Apple to reach lower price points without redesigning its entire product strategy. And then you have the supply chain complexity. A completely new lower price Mac would require Apple to manage a completely new manufacturing cost, new component sourcing, new pricing pressure across the Mac lineup. Apple's product lineup is deliberately simple compared with Windows PC makers. Introducing a low-cost Mac could complicate that structure. The cost skepticism. Many analysts believe the concept of a $600 Mac sounds appealing, but it may conflict with Apple's long-standing business model. Apple tends to prioritize profitability, product simplicity, and premium positioning over chasing market share at lower price tiers. The interesting twist, ironically, is that the same company that avoids cheap laptops is the one that created the mass market personal computing revolution with devices like the iMac G3, iPod, and iPhone. So, while analysts are skeptical, Apple has surprised the industry before. And operating systems typically receive firmware updates over time with bug fixes and security patches. But when those devices hit end-of-life status and official support stops, they can get compromised due to becoming more vulnerable as time goes on. When that happens, it's usually a good idea to upgrade your device, like a series of outdated routers that the FBI has flagged in a flash notice. The agency lists 12 routers which have reached end of life that could be compromised through malware injections, leading to a botnet for launching coordinated attacks or to sell access to the routers via proxy services. Most of the devices are from Linksys, with a single router from Cisco and from what the FBI has shared in its notice. These routers have been compromised by threat actors. The malware targets remote management software and bypasses administrative passwords to gain shell access. If you are still using one of the affected routers, the FBI recommends replacing it with a newer, factory-supported option. Really, if you still have 2.4 GHz router, you need to upgrade anyway, as single-band units can bottleneck your Wi-Fi connection. How hackers gain access to affected routers? According to the FBI, this exploitation method takes advantage of outdated remote management software installed on older routers. Attackers use known vulnerabilities in the router software to upload malware. In other words, they're taking advantage of security weaknesses that would have likely been patched or fixed in modern hardware. Once connected, the router is used to establish botnets, which are a connected series of compromised devices used to carry out further attacks on other networks or users. One of the world's largest botnets had compromised over 19 million devices before it was dismantled in 2024. Once infected, the devices communicate via a command and control server, which confirms whether they're still active and available for exploitation. Malware tools can also be used to compromise networks by opening up ports and channeling connections through proxy servers, which can siphon off sensitive data like unencrypted passwords or account details. In the past, aggressive malware has targeted gaming systems and gained access to the data contained within. Once infected, this malware is difficult to detect. So again, the best answer to the problem is to upgrade your equipment. If you do upgrade, make sure to avoid Consumer Reports' list of cheap routers, as many are not up to par in regards of performance and usability. NASA will try its Artemis II launch again in early April. The agency anticipates about 4 launch opportunities between April 1 and April 6. NASA will soon give it another go on April Fool's Day. On Thursday, NASA said it's targeting April 1st at 6:24 p.m. Eastern Time for the Artemis II mission next launch attempt. In case that date doesn't pan out, NASA added April 2nd at 7:22 p.m. as a secondary launch opportunity. If necessary, the agency foresees several more openings between April 1st and the 6th to get the Orion rocket into space. Within those 6 days between the 1st and the 6th, we can't always turn around every day for an attempt, NASA Acting Associate Administrator Lori Glaze said at a press conference. We would anticipate about 4 opportunities within that 6-day period. In preparation, NASA is targeting March 19th, a day from today, to roll Artemis II back out to the launch pad. However, it warned that further setbacks could occur. While I'm comfortable and the agency is comfortable with targeting April 1st as our first opportunity, just keep in mind we still have work to go, Glaze said. There are still things that need to be done within the vehicle assembly building and out at the pad. As always, we'll be guided by what the hardware is telling us, and we will launch when we're ready. Artemis II is set to be NASA's first crew lunar mission since the early 1970s. The 10-day mission will carry 4 astronauts around the moon and back to the Earth. It is set to be the first crewed mission of the Orion spacecraft and an important step toward the ultimate goal of a moon landing. Initially targeted for early February, the launch was pushed back to March after several issues arose during a wet dress rehearsal. Then 18 days later, it was delayed again and moved off the launch pad. When NASA discovered a helium flow blockage in the rocket's upper stage, and it's all happening against the backdrop Administrator Jared Isaacman's overhaul of the Artemis program, which includes postponing a scheduled moon landing until 2028. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how all this intertwines. And I want to talk about there's a hidden cost to something called shadow IT. And every IT pro has discovered an unofficial tool or service that somebody quietly adopted to get their job done. And it usually starts small, it feels harmless, and it's not even malicious. Most of the time, it's a sign that employees are trying to solve real problems with whatever they can find. But the moment all of these tools, all of these ideas slip outside of the visibility of IT or the managers or whatever, they can create risks that are going to grow faster than anyone might ever expect. Shadow IT isn't a technology problem. To me, I think of it as a communication problem that shows up as a technology problem. So why do people do this? Why do they go to unofficial tools? Well, the official ones may feel slow or confusing or poorly matched to whatever it is that we want to actually do. And many teams feel various pressures. They want to move quickly, and I get it. Sometimes IT approval can feel slow. It feels like it's going to slow down your momentum. And some employees simply don't realize that the choices that they make have more than just security implications. They have implications in regards to the lifetime of the business, the ability to recover after some kind of business or disaster situation that happens. And yeah, sometimes approval process is so complex that employees give up and they say, I'll just solve this on my own. And you might see a cloud app and you assume that it's safe because it looks professional. You might see something here that says, hey, this can solve it. There are programs. Dropbox was one of the big ones early on that everybody in IT was going, what is going on? Why is everybody sharing files here instead of out on the network? And that created a scary risk for a lot of companies. So shadow IT, it does grow in those gaps between what the business needs and what the official tools provide. But all of these risks start accumulating, start building up. If you have an unapproved tool and it stores data in places that the company cannot monitor, that creates a blind spot that attackers can exploit. That's where we went with when we had the big, huge Dropbox situation. Everybody was looking at this going, you can't put our company files out on the cloud. That's a scary spot. We can't keep track of them. You can put things out there. Well, we didn't want to really advertise this. You can put things out there that if it got out into the open public, that could be bad. You could take your information with you. Now, a lot of companies have locked down the idea of using Dropbox, but there's a lot of other things that come along with this idea. There are employees constantly that will use personal accounts for business tasks. And the idea of you're using Gmail for company business, all of a sudden the company loses control over access, and offboarding becomes really messy and sometimes impossible. And there's also operational risks that come along with shadow IT. If a key employee leaves, the knowledge of how their unofficial tools work, how those all intertwine with the business, all of that knowledge just leaves. It's gone. Of course, if it breaks something, that's another risk. All of a sudden, hey, you know, I've got this software. It's just like Dropbox, but I think it's better. I need you to fix this. Wait, what? No, you shouldn't be using Dropbox. You shouldn't be using this so-called better than Dropbox alternative. You can't be doing this. And all of a sudden, we've got problems too. Because anything you use that the IT department doesn't know about, all of a sudden that becomes a situation where they're scared. They don't know how to maybe necessarily fix the problems you're having. Okay, yeah, I can fix problems with Dropbox. I can fix problems with OneDrive, with Google Drive, but Moe's Drive? I've never heard of this. The danger isn't always in the tool itself. It's the lack of visibility, the lack of plans, and all of that. Now, I get this. You may really be in a situation where you want to turn to outside tools, and you really shouldn't. This is something where I get it. You're telling me that there's something about your workflow that the current tools do not support, or you don't think they support. I'll tell you, working with IT should always be a situation where they're serving you. That you as an employee or a customer of the company, IT should be serving you, even though you are right there next to them. You need to partner with them. You really need to open up that lines of communication. You need to say, look, I'm using this. How do I get off of this? How do I get onto something within the company that can do what I need? Help me find that path forward. Okay, I get it now. Okay, I need to get away from the shadow IT. I need to get involved in what we can do here. This is what you should be saying. I need to do things the right way. And using IT, they should be seen as a resource. You should feel comfortable asking for help. If you're not feeling comfortable asking for help, that's another issue. You need to get everybody involved. Everybody needs to be working together. IT should be a trusted partner with you, your coworkers, and the entire company, not just some kind of gatekeeper that says, yeah, you can only use this, and if it doesn't work for you, too bad. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. IT sector unemployment rising faster than the national average. The most recent U.S. data shows that tech-related workers make up a noticeable share of the unemployed, with IT sector unemployment rising faster than the national average. While the Bureau of Labor Statistics does not publish a single percent of unemployed who worked in tech, available figures estimate the scale of tech sector unemployment relative to the broader labor market. Analysts note long job searches and persistent unemployment among experienced tech workers. Tech is not a single Bureau of Labor Statistics industry category. IT-specific unemployment counts do not include all tech-adjacent roles. For example, product, design, data science, and hardware engineering. Even though tech workers are a small share of total U.S. unemployment, the rate of unemployment within tech is rising faster than in the general workforce. And what causes it? Workers aren't quitting their jobs. And here's why that's a problem for the labor market. The incentive is to change job is disappearing in this fragile labor market, making it harder for unemployed people to gain footing. Americans looking for employment have one more thing to worry about: the workers who are holding on to their jobs with an iron grip. People's willingness to leave their jobs is widely seen as a barometer of confidence in the labor market. And right now that indicator is flashing red. The share of employees who quit their jobs in January was 2% only. Labor Department data showed, and February survey data from the New York Federal Reserve showed, workers' perceived probability of leaving a job voluntarily in the next year hit a record low in data going back to 2013. The probability of losing your job has not gone up all that much. But if you lose your job, the probability of finding a new one, that's gotten harder. That's gone down. Laura Aldrich, Director of Economic Research in North America at Indeed Hiring Lab, told Yahoo Finance, "It's especially true in the sectors that have low hires and low quit rates," she added, "where they're just not seeing room made for new people." Aldrich pointed to government, financial activities, and manufacturing, which all have quit rates below 1.5%. In an economy that's hardly sustaining any payroll growth outside of the healthcare sector and amid persistent fears of AI-induced layoffs, it only makes sense that those with jobs are treating them like precious jewels. But that leaves those without them trapped between stagnant hiring and the anxious employed. There were just 0.94 jobs available for every unemployed person in January, compared to the roughly 2 positions open for each out-of-work American in the white-hot labor market of 2022. It no longer pays the job hop. The Federal Reserve Beige Book hinted at the trend this month, with the Boston Fed reporting an increase in applicants, as well as some experienced workers applying for junior-level positions. The New York Fed also noted labor supply generally continued to exceed labor demand, while the Cleveland Fed found increased availability of qualified candidates as larger firms slowed hiring. That intense competition for jobs, combined with workers' reluctance to leave, give employers the upper hand. Pay growth for job switchers is slowing, according to data tracked by ADP, with the premium for job hoppers getting a record low in February in data dating back to 2020. That may only further incentivize staying put, since pay for job stayers is steadier. Taylor Bowley, an economist at the Bank of America Institute, also flagged this pattern in a March 3 note, writing that the median pay raise associated with a job change has moderated for both men and women, with January levels measuring less than half that of 2019 average. Looking ahead, if low hire, low fire continues to characterize the labor market, the job change premium could compress further, limiting the extent to which workers can secure meaningful pay bumps by switching roles, Bowley wrote. Musical chairs have gone cold. Jasmine Escarilera, a career expert at My Perfect Resume, said that an October survey by the assistance platform found 65% of workers plan not to look for a new job in 2026. The question is whether that's because they're satisfied or is it because they're terrified. Escalera said, signs point to the latter, at least for some. We are seeing that people take a long time to find jobs, Escalera said, and it isn't about qualifications or skill sets. It's about the competition in the market. For the job seekers, this is really sad. Indeed, long-term unemployment is creeping up, with a quarter of out-of-work Americans unemployed for 27 weeks or longer as of February. Anyone watching that trend who still has a job, no matter how bad it is, might be a bit skittish about jumping ship. Lauren Thomas, an economist at Deel, a human resources company, said that seems particularly true for workers under 24 who in 2024 had the highest rate of job hopping. Now, she said, they're typically staying where they are and have experienced the sharpest drop in job switching among other age groups. Their anxiety isn't without reason. Just in New York City, long a place where young job seekers flock, entry-level postings plummeted more than 37% between 2022 and 2024. According to a recent report from the Center for an Urban Future, if you're early in your career, looking for a new job might force you into the most troubled job market in years. There's good reason for people to quit their jobs, whether it's to move to a position with a better opportunity or better pay or change sectors, or to move to a new town, Ulrich said. When the churn is taken out of the labor market and layoff rates are low, which they are, what happens is you don't have opportunities for new people to enter. The impact of AI installations on the steeply rising cost of memory. Artificial intelligence is rapidly transforming the technology landscape. Companies across industries are investing heavily in AI systems, building new data centers, and deploying powerful computing infrastructure to train and run advanced models. But this surge in AI development is creating an unexpected side effect, a sharp rise in the cost of computer memory. Memory is one of the foundational components of modern computing. Nearly every digital device depends on it. Smartphones, laptops, cloud servers, gaming systems, and enterprise software platforms all require memory to temporarily store and move data while programs are running. The more complex the task, the more memory a system typically needs. AI workloads are among the most memory-intensive tasks ever created. Training modern AI models requires processing enormous data sets using specialized chips designed for high-performance computing. Graphics processing units, or GPUs, have become the workhorses of AI because they can process large volumes of data in parallel. Companies like NVIDIA design many of the GPUs that power today's AI systems. But powerful processors alone are not enough. These chips must constantly move massive amounts of data between the processor and memory. To keep up with this demand, AI systems increasingly rely on extremely fast memory technology such as high bandwidth memory, commonly known as HBM. HBM is significantly faster than traditional memory used in personal computers. However, it's also more complex and expensive to manufacture. Producing it requires advanced packaging techniques and highly specialized fabrication processes. This is where the supply challenge begins. As AI adoption accelerates, demand for high-performance memory has surged dramatically. Many cloud providers and AI developers are purchasing huge amounts of memory to build out the infrastructure. Companies such as Microsoft, Google, and Amazon are investing billions of dollars in new AI data centers that require massive amounts of advanced memory. On the supply side, only a handful of companies manufacture the most advanced memory chips. Firms like Samsung Electronics, SK Hynix, and Micron Technology dominate the global memory market. These companies are expanding production, but building new fabrication capacity takes years and requires enormous capital investment. The result is a classic supply and demand imbalance. As AI companies compete for limited supplies of high-performance memory, prices are being pushed upwards. Even traditional memory components used in consumer electronics can feel the effects when manufacturers shift production capacity toward higher-margin AI memory products. This ripple effect can influence the price of everyday devices, personal computers, gaming systems, smartphones, and enterprise servers all rely on memory chips. When memory prices rise, hardware manufacturers must either absorb the cost or pass it on to customers. For consumers, this may mean higher prices for new devices or fewer memory upgrades included in entry-level systems. For businesses, the impact can be even greater. Data centers that run cloud computing platforms depend on vast amounts of memory to operate efficiently. Rising component costs can increase the expense of building and expanding these facilities. Ironically, the very technologies designed to power the next generation of AI may also contribute to higher infrastructure costs across the broader technology market. Over time, the market will likely adapt. Memory manufacturers are investing heavily in new production lines and next-generation technologies. As supply expands, the pricing pressure may ease. But for now, the global race to deploy AI systems is reshaping the economics of one of the computing's most essential components. Memory has always been critical to digital technology. In the age of artificial intelligence, it's becoming even more valuable and increasingly expensive. The AI showdown, ChatGPT versus Grok versus Claude, Perplexity versus Gemini. What is each best at? Wartoo's comparison guides helps you choose between ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, Grok, and Perplexity based on your specific needs and workflow. The AI revolution is here, and choosing the right language model is like picking the right wine for dinner. Pair it well, and everyone's impressed. Screw it up, and you're left with a bad taste in your mouth. Or worse, a failed project. With options like Gemini, ChatGPT, Claude, Grok, and Perplexity, finding the perfect AI co-pilot can feel like speed dating for nerds. There aren't just chatbots. There's specialized tools that can boost your productivity, spark creativity, and even make you look smarter than you actually are. ChatGPT is the Swiss Army knife that actually delivers on every blade. Ever feel like juggling chainsaws while trying to brainstorm, write copy, and code a website? ChatGPT is like that hyper-competent friend who somehow aced every class. It's the Swiss Army knife for productivity, flexing multimodal muscles to handle text, images, and even files. Writers staring at blank pages find salvation here. Developers knee-deep in code gets unstuck fast. Need to cook up a new marketing strategy or create content that doesn't suck? ChatGPT handles it with style. Plus, its adaptable tone means tweaking it to sound like a slightly less annoying version of yourself. For custom workflows, you got Grok, your hyper-caffeinated research assistant who speaks fluent internet. Meet Grok, the AI that actually gets what's trending. Unlike your uncle still sharing decade-old memories, this isn't just another fact-spitting machine. It serves up real-time social data and cultural insights with a side of conversational humor. Think of Grok as the social media that's guiding marketers and journalists through the wilderness of online trends. It monitors social media chatter, providing quick, authentic responses so professionals don't have to wade through endless feeds. Basically, it's the AI that gets the joke before everyone else does. And then you have Gemini, which is Google's answer to herding digital cats. Google entered the business collaboration arena with mixed results. You remember Google Wave? Gemini supports multimodal inputs, text, images, files, so showing the AI what's up beats explaining everything from scratch. Coordinating projects with multiple stakeholders sound like herding cats. right? Gemini streamlines team coordination by integrating seamlessly with Google Workspace. Project planning transforms from a chaotic mess of emails and spreadsheets into a well-oiled machine. Finally, something that makes group projects bearable, Claude. The AI that reads the fine print so nobody else has to. For legal egos drowning in documents, Claude is the AI equivalent of a caffeinated paralegal. Forget skimming. It dives deep thanks to its ability to handle documents up to 2,000 tokens. That's War and Peace worth of legal jargon. Think of it as the AI that actually reads the fine print. Claude uses logical flow and document analysis for rewriting and reviewing complex materials. When safety and ethical reasoning are non-negotiable, this is the AI professional want on their side. Perfect for contract reviews, policy analysis, and any task where accuracy matters more than speed. And then, of course, you have Perplexity, your digital Sherlock Holmes with a built-in fact checker. Navigating online information feels like walking through a digital minefield these days. Perplexity offers a fact-checked flashlight in that chaos, shining real-time web data onto every claim. It's like having a tiny digital detective, complete with transparency and evidence-based answers. Academic researchers and fact-checkers treat Perplexity like oxygen in a sea of misinformation. Instead of endless links, it delivers validated truth with citations attached. Best for verification and data validation when trusting something online actually matters, and AI that shows it works. The wine pairing metaphor holds. Mix and match these tools based on what's on your plate. Use Perplexity for research, ChatGPT for drafting, Claude for reviewing, Grok for trend spotting, and Gemini for team coordination. What happens to your Android phone when left on 24/7? In this heavily connected day and age, the mere notion of powering down your phone must sound absolutely inconceivable. After all, what if you miss an important call or text or notification from your socials? Unpleasant as that notion may sound, you should power down your Android phone every once in a while, because if you don't, it could experience even more unpleasant problems like memory leaks and security issues. Disregarding regular shutdowns is one of the things you absolutely should not do with your Android phone. An Android smartphone is ostensibly supposed to be on 24/7, keeping you connected to your news, socials, and whatever else, much like the other electronics in your home. Though, and especially your PC, an Android phone is kind of like a living thing. It needs a periodic rest to clear out old data and shore itself against the potential of attacks. Your phone can go for days on end without needing to power down entirely. Yes, but if you remember to give it a solid break at least once a week, you may find your phone perform a little more steadily. The occasional power cycling may also help to ensure your phone's overall longevity. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Mark Brownstein.
Mark Brownstein joins me now. And Mark, we've talked about some bird stuff in the past, and you've got a new one for the birds. Well, for bird watchers, really. So tell us about this.
This actually takes it beyond what we've done. I've done two other things with this. We had a program that would listen to the birds and identify what kind of birds it was listening to. We had a product that the Haiku Box that was able to listen to and identify the birds, and it was a 24/7 thing. So you could actually go to the software on your phone and see what kind of a bird it was and hear how many times they saw it during a day. And it's interesting because migratory birds come through here, and you could see the migrations just by the birds being identified by sound. But now we take it to the next step. You can actually see the birds feeding.
Okay, so it's got a camera arrangement?
it's got a camera in it, and they've got a few different kinds from a few different manufacturers, anywhere from HD to 4K. Not sure why you'd get 4K. This one from TT Nature, the smart bird feeder, they've got 6 or 8 different ones. They've got cameras. They, of course, are bird feeders. The one that I have reviewed was easy to assemble. It's easy to hook up. You put the camera in, you hook it up to a solar panel, and it's always on. It's always on. At night, there's not anything much to see. But during the daytime, you've got all kinds of birds that you could see feeding. What I'm seeing most likely, most recently, though, is squirrels. They love these things. And I can see really up close. See their cute little ears, and I haven't named them yet, but we have squirrels eating, and it's kind of hard to chase them off. I have to walk outside and run after them with a rake or something. But they know when I'm running after them, it's not just an alarm.
Yeah,
I know that they're there. Yeah. But it's interesting. Some can identify what kind of bird just from the look of it, and this one will, but you've got to pay for a subscription every month for the capability of finding out what kind of a bird it identifies. Not sure I like that. Some of them actually include that in the price, and the price, of course, is inflated. But the TT Nature does a good job. It's easy to fill the food. There's a lid on the thing, so squirrels are not going to be able to open it and get into it. Does a pretty good job. It's Wi-Fi. I've got it 30 or 40 feet away from the router, and it picks up the signal, and it does just fine.
Nice. Okay.
And I wish that these bird feeders have modified doorbells on them. Not that the bird's going to ring the doorbell, or the squirrel will.
Yeah.
But so I can go to my phone and say, hey, get away from there. If it's a squirrel taking up all the food.
Yeah. So I get it. So kind of like the Ring doorbell where you can actually communicate out and you can go ahead and do some interaction mostly with the squirrels.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They don't do that. They've just got cameras, and the cameras identify. But, if there's some way to make it bidirectional, maybe that would help.
I will tell you, I've got some Blink cameras, and that is one of the selling points of those. They're wireless and just run on a couple of AA lithium batteries, and they'll go for, I think, about 8 or 9 months as a good, suitable outdoor camera, like by the garage. And I can communicate with whoever is outside by the garage, say, hey, coming around to the front door, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I need to change my doorbell. But, I know these things are good. These things help. And being able to do that on your phone or on your computer really helps.
Yeah. So there's a lot, of course, to the whole bird watching community. It is actually quite amazing how many people enjoy doing that.
That's true. And I never, when I started doing reviews, thought I would be doing reviews of 3 different products.
Yeah.
But you kind of get hooked into it. It's interesting to see the birds. You can see the birds up front feeding at the feeder. Right next to the camera, and you could turn the sound on. So when they fly away, you got the wings. It's an interesting sound.
Yeah.
I've had birds fighting for space for the food. So it's more than just looking at pictures of birds.
Yeah. So what is the price point for that?
This one is $100.
Okay.
Or just a little bit under.
So that's really approachable. What's the subscription fee though?
I think it's $8 a month.
Okay. Yeah. That's one of those areas where I kind of get stuck. Great products, but then we're tied into that monthly or annual fee that just slowly wears your bank account down.
Razors and blades, but
yes,
there are others.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the old Gillette theory. give away the razors, you make money on the blades. And some of these feeders, though, they'll be more expensive, but you get free subscription.
Yeah.
So after a couple of years, they pay for themselves.
Yeah, definitely. That is something that we should all be taking into account. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Mark Brownstein.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Mark. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. King's Bite Computer Club meets Thursday, March the 19th. Meeting time is 5:30 p.m. They meet at the Brooklyn Heights Public Library, Orange Meeting Room, located at 286 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, March the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 3rd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect, Tuesday, April the 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It's a hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is techedconnect.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, April 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN live streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the Personal Computer Show programs are available on prn.live and podbeam.com. We welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear, as well as any questions for us. Address your comments to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Brendan Kidwell, Benjamin Rockwell, Mark Brownstein, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.